This podcast is hosted by Chris Finkston and Spencer Oliver. They are both experienced paramedics. They've done everything from 911 ground ambulance to volunteer fire department work and are both currently flight paramedics. This podcast reviews scenarios based on real calls run by real out-of-hospital clinicians. Details are changed to protect the privacy of those involved and to present educational opportunities to the listener. This podcast is EMS 2020. Hey, everybody, welcome to EMS 2020 with now new shortened pauses between welcome to and EMS 2020. New thing I'm trying out.
New and improved.
Yeah, new. I don't know about improved, but you know, it's there. So welcome to EMS 2020. My name is Chris. That is Spencer. And wow.
That was a weird pause. Is this what we're doing now? Where you're like EMS 2020? That is
that's the other
Spencer?
Guy. Yeah. Well, you know, I've been playing it out, possibly with you know, the idea of maybe saying someone else's name as the partner. But
somebody who will more consistently check a blood sugar. Is that what I'm hearing? That's fair.
Yeah, I wasn't going to bring it up, but since you did, you know. anyway, yeah. So, yeah, welcome everybody to EMS 2020. Thanks again for everyone who participated in the Code 3 Song Contest. Go ahead and check out our social media to check out that contest, the winners, and the playlist. Right now, we're going to go into some listener questions and comments on our last episode. But if you would like to be featured in this segment, go ahead and follow us on social media. We are EMS20/20 on Facebook, EMS2020 Show on Instagram, and you can email us at EMS2020podcast@gmail.com. That email address is also great for sending us your tales of woe or your tales of success. So Aaron left a comment on our Facebook page regarding last week's episode. If you guys recall last week's episode, a crew made an understandable misstep in their assessment process. And spoiler alert, you might want to skip ahead a few minutes just to miss this part here. Because it's a fantastic episode, and I wouldn't want to rob you guys of going on that mental journey with the crew if you haven't listened to it yet. But in our last episode titled, that episode that we totally did.
that fantastic episode that I wrote. It's nice of you to give me credit.
Yeah. There you go. Titled Narcan Needs a Break. It's a great episode. So yeah, go check it out if you haven't. So our crew basically misses a, and here's a spoiler, stroke in a patient due to believing that the patient's altered level of consciousness is due to possible narcotics overdose. We discussed some challenges in assessing for a stroke with an unresponsive patient, and one listener asked us this question on our social media. This is Aaron.
Aaron.
Aaron, exactly. So first of all, we are definitely going to include the gratuitous fluffing of our egos. The wife and I both love your podcast, and this was a good one. We both
thank
are
you.
EMTs. Yes, thank you, Aaron. We both are EMTs, and I am currently a medic student. Good job, Aaron. While listening to this week's episode, I was thinking traumatic head injury because it kind of sounded like Cushing's triad. Granted, heart rate was not really Brady, but it's still a path to consider. And for the record, Aaron, I agree. I consider this as well as Spencer was giving us the call. Anyways, main reason I am writing is during your podcast, we wondered if you could perform a Babinski or other reflex test on a patient who could not perform a stroke screen, and if that would show a possible stroke. Thanks, guys. Stay safe. So first of all, really quick, a Babinski reflex is a reflex in which stimulus is applied to the sole of the foot, and it causes the toes to flare out. So I really like this train of thought of testing an involuntary reflex, and I think the reasoning here is on point. That said, this wouldn't work out. We were able to research this one a bit, and there's a few issues with it.
I also really like this responder's train of thought. So a lot of EMS stroke assessments are based on sort of what we'll call a rough accuracy or likelihood of the patient having a stroke. You know, the goal for us is like, how can we identify and catch strokes in the field that would benefit from TPA or, you know, endovascular treatments, but also not be too sensitive and overload the hospitals with all the false positives because, there are just a ton of potential stroke mimics out there. So we see a lot of stroke scales in EMS that really just sort of look at a couple of things like speech, gross motor movement, you know, facial droop, etc. But none of those tests that appear, you know, for EMS really include any reflex tests like Babinski's sign. And so I think it's absolutely fair to wonder why. So this reflex question actually is a really interesting one, and one that I hadn't considered before. And so this is sort of where Chris and I deep dived into it. And so what we learned is that, yes, a lot of strokes will reduce or just plain take out those involuntary reflexes on the affected side, making the idea of reflex testing in EMS seem like it would be a good one. But as it turns out, not so much. So there are several cases we've read of patients who ended up having the opposite problem and had increased reflex response, called spasticity, as an early development of their ischemic stroke. So it's not as clear-cut as I might have thought, but it actually gets more interesting. So let's dive specifically into the Babinski reflex, because that test does seem like it would be the most promising possible reflex tool, given that we're taught that this finding in everyone over the age of about 1 or 2 years old is abnormal. But let's put a pin in that. And its presence could indicate damage to motor neurons in the brain and or along the cortical spinal tract.
Right. So we have a reflex test that seems like it would be a great predictor for stroke. But here's the catch. This sign doesn't show up in all ischemic strokes. Okay. Or it seems to show up hours after the onset of the stroke in cases where it is going to show up. Also, this reflex can allegedly be found in several other conditions that aren't even stroke related or motor neuron damage, such as a person in deep sleep or even a person who has done a lot of walking that day. Think like marathon level distances. Also, there are some false positives associated with this test based on improper technique. So we can see why it's not really being pushed out into EMS for acute CVA identification. By the way, the standard stroke assessment in hospitals is the NIH stroke scale, which is a point-based system and fairly in-depth and really accurate from the reviews that I've seen. It also doesn't use reflex in its scoring system either. So this kind of dovetails into my final point when we're talking about, you know, false positives with improper technique. Reflexes actually aren't that easy to assess, especially in an ambulance. Babinski's reflex may be a little bit easier because you don't need a ton of patient cooperation for it, but it can be done wrong. And other reflex tests, for example, like DTRs or deep tendon reflexes, that's the hammer on the tendon test.
Yeah.
To be done truly properly, it kind of requires the patient to be relaxed. They should have no load on that limb or tendon. This is the one you've all had done. And I'm going to tell you this, like, if you've ever been to the doctor's office and you've had it done, I've never seen my doctor try it just once. They always have to sit there and take 2 to 3 whacks at it. And that is, and that's in a doctor's office with good lighting and a cooperative patient. So trying to do this on someone who's potentially having a stroke is not a thing.
It's, dude, I've actually had them do it one, but this is what I think when they just do it once. I'm like, oh, they're just faking this. They're hitting my knee. And like, I don't think anything happened. And they're like, good enough.
They're just going to check a box. Just call it good. Yeah. But that's the thing, though, is whether it's the Babinski's or this, it would be really difficult to tell if there was no reflex or if you were just having improper technique. So for that reason, I would say trying to rely on a reflex test, or for these reasons, I would say that trying to rely on reflex tests for this just wouldn't be the best.
But excellent thought, Aaron. I really like this was actually like this was one where I was like, oh man, like this could be a thing.
Really? Yeah, absolutely. Actually, like to the point where I'm like, gosh, this is something like someone should do a paper on this, and then someone did, and you know, anyway, hey, I'm bringing words today. So you can all turn off now. No, I'm kidding. Today may be a longer episode, but this is it's such a fascinating call. I really like it. Oh, it's got all the challenges and it doesn't get better. It just hurts the more you listen, which is perfect for this show. So
today's, oh good. This is just what I want.
Yeah, exactly. Although I do feel this one's right up your alley, which is now just more pressure mounting on you. In other words, it has nothing to do with the CBG. I'm kidding.
Okay.
I'm kidding, actually, yeah. Anyway, so today's story comes to us from a rural area firefighter paramedic on a non-transporting agency. They are a new new paramedic. And this is what they describe as their first, air quotes around this, real call. System. So the description of the system is this. The fire department is a small, mostly volunteer agency in a rural community. They have three stations, but only one is actually staffed 24/7. The other two house like water tenders and engines, but are typically unstaffed. By the way, a water tender is basically a big truck, hauls a lot of water. If there's a call in the area, then the volunteers near those stations, the unstaffed stations, will respond to that station, grab the required equipment, and then proceed to the call. And even the 24/7 main station is only staffed with two firefighters, and they must wait for additional volunteers to show up to staff anything but the light rescue, which they're going to use later today. The good news is that the volunteers in the area are fairly active and often show up at least for the second out response. For medical calls, there is no minimum response threshold in terms of the number of personnel that are required to respond. So they could go with just one person. If all you have is one person at the station, they are allowed to respond by themselves. But typically two will go for most call types because it's usually staffed with two people. It's up to the crew once they get on scene to add additional resources. The shifts at the main station are 24 hours and typically only see one or two calls a day. And it's not uncommon to get skunked either, where you get no calls. All the volunteers are at least first responder level, but most are EMT basics, which, by the way, we don't talk about this level of EMT very much. There are several levels of EMT, and a lot of people think EMT basic is the entry level, but there actually is a level with a smaller scope of practice in EMT basic, and that is the FR, or first responder. But most of the people at this fire department are EMT basics. So today, the station is staffed with our super new paramedic and a newish EMT basic. When a medical 911 call drops, the fire department is dispatched as well as a private ambulance service for transport. The private ambulance service, even in the best case scenario, is typically 20 minutes away from any given scene, and today's call is going to be even farther than that. So, our paramedic is going to be dubbed Cub. His partner, Joey, is someone that is known... Not a lot of people get the kangaroo reference there, but you know, we have a lot of Aussie listeners, and I wanted to give a little shout-out to them today. So, his partner is someone that is known to Cub during drills, but not someone that they've ever worked with. Cub admits that they were a little uneasy, as they were also aware that Joey was new to the fire department. While Cub is a new paramedic, Cub is not that new to the fire department, having been there for almost 2 years. Cub believes Joey is fresh out of fire academy, and this may be Joey's second or third shift. Cub is hoping that this is another typical do-nothing shift, which may actually be the cause of this call's drama. Hoping for this bullshit is, I think, maybe the primary lesson we're going to take away from today's episode, because that almost guarantees that this is going to happen to you.
I don't believe in magic, but these moments kind of make you second guess your skepticism.
It's one of those things where
am I actually a wizard?
It's one of those things where it's like, I don't really believe in the superstitions either, but these are the kind of days that make me get it, why people do, you know? Like every once in a while I look at a horoscope and I'm like, oh wow, I nailed it, you know? A broken watch is right twice a day, some shit like that. All right, so but of course the do nothing day doesn't happen, and that's why it's on this show. So at 11:21:21,
wow, nice.
Or maybe it was 13:41:71, I don't know. But a call for a lift assist. For the lift assist of a 61-year-old female comes in off of a remote road about 15 minutes from their station, which makes it about 35 to 40 minutes away from the nearest transporting ambulance from the private ambulance system. Our crew takes their light rescue, which is basically a heavy-duty pickup with med kits. Quick note about lift assist, by the way. A lift assist is exactly what it sounds like. A person with decreased mobility has fallen or is stuck and they need help up. I know this might trigger Spencer, but it has no medical need.
Yeah.
which it actually triggers me too. That's the technical definition, but I'm with Spence on this.
So he's joking because we've had this conversation a while ago. So what they're finding out is that a lot of lift assists are actually sort of a, you know, like it's sort of a shot across the bow for a more significant medical problem. You know, like a lot of people who call because they need help getting up, something has changed in their condition that they are now requiring additional, like, you know, it's like, oh, they're old and weak, but they're weaker today for some reason. And what they're finding is that it's often like related to like, oh, fuck, they're actually early sepsis. You know, I'm not going to go too deep into this. There's a podcast that did a really good job on this. The Second Shift podcast really covered this topic. They had sources and they were able to, you know, give specific numbers and all of that. So what I would recommend is everybody just go cheat on us for a moment, listen to the Second Shift podcast, and then come back to us. We'll still love you. Mm-hmm. They did a really good job on that. Yeah. So go check that one out.
But anyway, we know what sorry, you go like, on. So come on back.
Anyway. Come on back.
Right. But typically, though, when it just comes down to ellipsis, they don't add an ambulance to these calls. That has to be added either by the responding crew or if something changes when the person's taking the call. So, also, Cub is decently certain that they have heard of this patient just kind of based on the address and the fact that they do a number of lift assists here, and believes this patient is a bariatric patient that frequently gets stuck on the toilet. I want to explain really quick why toilets are essentially the flypaper for the population with decreased mobility. The reason being is that many toilets, not all, are a lot lower than your typical seat. And if you have mobility issues, whether it's excess weight or, you know, joint injury, those kind of things, to go from a position where your bottom is lower than the level of your knees, for example, so that kind of that squat position, and then to try and get back up is really, really difficult to do. And so toilets, especially if there's not appropriate like rails or handrails to boost yourself up, are common places for people to get stuck. So shortly after starting their code one, that's no lights or sirens, journey to this call, they are upgraded to code 3 as the caller says the patient is having trouble breathing. They turn on the lights and sirens and proceed to the call. They hear that an ambulance has been added as well, which is great, and are estimating them to be about 35 minutes out. 5 minutes later, Cub and Joey arrive at a small house. They bring in a cardiac monitor, a med bag, which is your IVs, medications, a CBG kit, Spence, and the airway bag.
Okay, I'm getting the hint. I'm getting the hint.
Well, you're the one that say, oh, yeah, if I see it, I'll recognize it. Anyway, sorry. So I just want to make sure you fucking see it. All right. Now I got to calm down. Now I'm just throwing punches. Anyway. The airway meds, O2 tank, and intubation equipment are in the airway bag. So the house is not in the greatest condition. There's like dilapidated old vehicles that kind of litter the yard, which is a super common feature, by the way, in rural communities. I don't know why. The outside is...
I also don't know.
Yeah, but there's just a ton of them. And it's always the same thing. Yeah, I'm going to get that up and running someday. Okay. anyway, the outside is dirty. Like the siding is like got dirt on it. There's some overgrowth going on. A man who we're going to call Jeb, waves to the crew from the front door, signaling them to come on in. The inside isn't terrible, but it's certainly messy, but like not to the point to like hinder movement.
Yeah. Quick question here. What's the spider to human ratio in this place?
I wouldn't say, I think just... This is not from the person that gave us the call, but from the houses I'm imagining. This isn't the kind of house where you see a lot of spiders. It's the kind of house where you see the weird, like, millipede-looking things, like the bizarre bugs that just make your skin crawl. Like, spiders make my skin crawl, but there are some bugs I'm like, I don't know what that is, and it has 100 legs. That's what I feel this is. So, so Jeb tells the crew that he just says she's stuck again as they get in, but also says, and she seems like she can't breathe or it's her sugar or something. Thanks for casting that wide net, Jeb.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. That's, you know, it's either this thing that presents one way or this thing that presents an entirely different way. But anyway, he then adds that they'll need more people because the patient is almost 700 pounds. Quick note about bariatric weights. Oftentimes, patients who are this large do not have a scale at home. So the monitoring of their weight really only occurs whenever they visit a physician's office. If they're not visiting a physician's office very frequently, their weights can often be inaccurate and they can be far more or less than what you're given. So always round up for safety. So, yeah. Cub begins their assessment in the seconds between meeting Jeb and meeting the patient, as Jeb leads them through the house and into the bathroom, as so many of us often do. And that's actually not too bad. Start your assessment as soon as you can. Pick up clues. Look at the house. And Cub admits that he kind of felt a bit scattered. Cub begins to inquire about what is being said to them. So Cub asks, is the patient diabetic, or has she ever had a low blood sugar? And this is kind of a thing that I've caught myself doing, too, is instead of assessing the patient, you're assessing what Jeb told you. And it can kind of start you off in the middle of your assessment, and that can be difficult to recover from. But let's see how it goes. So Jeb responds by saying, yeah, she's a diabetic, and then chastises Cub for apparently not knowing that diabetes causes high blood sugar, not low blood sugar. Cub was obviously assuming the sugar was low when Jeb said it was her sugar. Jeb responds with, she's always in the 200s because she has diabetes. I think the last time she got like this, it was way high. As they arrive to the doorway of the restroom, Cub is trying to explain why low blood sugar is common in diabetics as they glance into the room. Jeb, who still thinks Cub has no idea what they're talking about, cuts off Cub and says, well, there she is. Do your thing, I guess. Cub sees a morbidly obese patient on the floor between the bathtub and the toilet. Toilet to the patient's right, bathtub to the patient's left. The patient is tipped to their left, appearing as though they, like, tipped left off the toilet and then fell between the space. So she's kind of laying on her left side against the tub. Kind of the way to describe to this was described to me. And I don't know if I fully comprehended the position the patient was in, but this is kind of where I'm going with it. She's laying on her left side against the tub, but she's not completely on her left side. The space between the toilet and the tub is enough for this patient to be seated in between without really squeezing them if they were sitting bolt upright. So if you can imagine placing a large 700-pound patient between a toilet and a tub, and they have enough room, and then pushing them onto their left side, you would have someone that's kind of at a 45-degree angle, angling towards their left, with their head kind of resting on the wall of the tub.
Okay. No, I think that helps clear it up, because I was trying to imagine, I'm like, okay, hold on. So she's in between, but she's laying, but okay. So she's actually just sort of laying against the tub, 45-degree angle, on her, like, and with her left side just sort of like against the tub.
Yeah. The patient's eyes are closed, but she opens them when Joey says, ma'am, so loudly, the patient likely now has hearing loss. All right, Spence, it's your turn to choose your own adventure. Do you want the HPI first, or do you want the assessment first?
Ooh, let's do assessment. I'm curious.
Okay, perfect. So Cub dives right into the assessment. Joey, after performing an impromptu hearing test, proceeds to do the tap and shout and rocks the patient. The patient opens their eyes but has no verbal response. Joey, making Cub even more nervous now, reports this finding as, well, she's awake.
Finger raise. Not really, right, but okay.
Yeah.
Go on.
It's funny. Your summation makes it seem like this is normal. Like we're good. We're not. So Cub asks Joey to give a small sternal rub, which Joey does, and the patient's eyes open, and she says stop, and seems to shrug her shoulders almost as though she's flexing them inward. So she's kind of withdrawing from the pain there. Cub concludes at this point, the patient gets a GCS of 11. So 3, because eyes open to verbal. Gives her a 4 instead of a 5, because although you can't really say she's confused, because the stop kind of makes sense, it'd be hard to give them full points for verbal. So it drops down to a 4. And then gives him a 4 for motor, because a 6 would be purposeful movement, 5 would be localizing pain, 4 is appropriate withdrawal from pain, which is what she did.
By the way, question for you, maybe you were able to get this. Like, is she able to move her arms, or are they kind of like trapped by the apparatus of the tub and the
left
toilet?
The left arm is entirely trapped. You can see they can see the left hand, but the left arm is underneath the left side of her body, kind of against the tub. But the right arm is there.
Okay, so she could have, like, if she wanted to localize, like, she would have probably been able to reach up with her right arm and, like, knock his hand away. So, withdrawal makes sense.
And honestly, so kind of a quick tangent, this is one of the reasons I really don't care for sternal rubs, though, is because, like Spencer mentioned, the appropriate response to sternal rub is actually to kind of withdraw your chest sometimes. People may put up a hand. I really like like doing an IV or even like nail bed rubs, because it's kind of, I think there's more of an ability for a patient to localize pain that way, as opposed to just simply withdrawing, versus sternal rubs kind of hard.
Yeah, no, that's true. The nail bed thing hurts like hell, though. Jesus.
Yeah, it does. But I mean, that is the goal. And it looks less assaulty. But anyway, so.
Truth.
Punching someone in the chest.
I like that. Assaulty.
Yeah,
I like
exactly.
That.
Assaultish. The patient's skin feels warm to the touch. The patient's pupils appeared appropriately sized for the lighting condition. Quick tip, by the way, when assessing pupils, it's often worth it to note the pupil size of other responders. Pupils, like all vital signs, need context. And it appears the Cub took this into account. So good work, Cub. I have been on people who are like, look, the pupils are constricted. It's like, yeah, it's summer and we're in a parking lot. My pupils are constricted too. So the patient's nice. Head appears atraumatic and no bleeding is noted. So, Spence, what vital signs would you want to know?
So on the AFPU, she's verbal. She does tell them to stop when they do the sternal rub. The pupils appear, you know, sounds like they're equal reactive, which is excellent. The skin is warm. She's got good color. Were they able to have any other verbal communication with her? Is that basically like she just told him to stop and then she's not talking anymore?
That's it. She told him to stop and then she went back to closing her eyes and not talking.
Confusion seems appropriate then. Quick question. Did they get lung sounds?
No, but this is something that they thought about. One of the main reasons that they did not get the lung sounds, and I agree with this, Cub felt that trying to get lung sounds from the front was going to be difficult, given the amount of fatty tissue, and that access to the back would really aid in that.
Okay, gotcha. And they're not able to get back there. Got it.
No, because her back's against the wall right now.
And then real quick, did they have anything else on the rest of the body, like any DCAP BTLS? I love that acronym.
Yeah, well, what does it stand for?
All right.
You are too excited for this.
deformities. Deformities. I haven't seen this. It's EMT basic shit. Deformities, contusions, abrasions, punctures, burns, right? Yeah.
Yep.
Burns, tenderness, lacerations, swelling.
Nailed it. That's it. That's the whole thing. Yes. It's been several decades since EMT Basic?
I just said DCAP BTLS because nobody has ever asked me like, all right, what do you look for? I'm like DCAP BTLS.
Nice.
And nobody's ever been like, okay, what's the D stand for? Nothing there, right?
No, nothing there.
Okay. I guess then I would like a respiration rate.
Don't have an exact number, but fast and shallow is what it was remembered as.
Okay. Let's get a heart rate.
Heart rate is 124.
And were they able to get an SpO2?
Yeah, they got an SpO2, 91%, room air.
Okay, what about a blood pressure?
So they were not able to get one. They did not have a bariatric cuff with them. Joey does attempt to place the manual cuff over the wrist and do that palpation motion, but is unable to find a radial. And that's potentially due to anatomical changes associated with morbid obesity. When I've tried the wrist palpation, I've been pretty unsuccessful with it too, because you tend to pump it up. And then what happens? All the forearm fat gets pushed down right over where you need to be feeling for a radial.
Or the cuff migrates down for some reason, because it's a cone, essentially.
Right. Exactly. Yeah, their forearm is in the shape of a cone, and the cuff is not. The cuff is built to go around perfect cylinders, which no one has. So,
How about a blood sugar?
Did you?
I felt like you really didn't want me to fuck this one up this time. Like at some point we start losing credibility.
Actually, look, this entire podcast has been a ruse. This has just been to teach you to finally check for blood sugars ever since this last journey.
Now we can finally stop. Yeah. Is that what I'm hearing?
Exactly. Now we can finally stop the podcast. We've made it. So the CBG comes back and it reads high, greater than 500.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well, I'm glad I checked. And I guess, like, are they able to put her on the cardiac monitor?
Yeah, they got her on a 3-lead and just comes back with sinus tach and some PVCs are going by.
Okay.
So, gotcha. Really quick, another mention was that Cub said they noticed a fruity breath smell on the patient as well. And why are you going, Spencer?
Well, that's sort of a sign that's associated with a patient who is burning fat and creating ketones due to the fact that there's no insulin to let the sugar into the cells for metabolism. I will be honest. I have disregarded the fruity breath smell because I have a nose that smells just nothing, or nothing really good anyway. And so I've never actually encountered this in the field, even with like multiple DKA patients.
Yeah.
I've never encountered this. So it's not a great thing for me, but I remember what it's associated with. Yeah. So
as often as it's mentioned, I can only really think of one time that I smelled it. And that was, we had a 20 something year old male who was just trying to put on his tidy whities before we got there. And, he ended up being a DKA patient. He was unsuccessful in getting them on though. So he was pretty confused.
Quick question. Yeah. Were they actually tight and white, or were they like kind of loose and gray? Cause that's,
I hate the loose gray tidy whities. Oh God. But yeah, there are those. So, if you want to go to our Facebook page and we have a video, just go to the videos on our Facebook page and we have a little video. It's just an excerpt of Spencer and I talking about one such case that it's pretty funny. So,
okay.
Yeah. So the thing about the fruity breath smell, yeah, it is a sign of ketones, but I kind of want to point this out. There's a lot of things that can smell fruity on a breath. Like, I don't know, like could be something she ate. It's, I don't know. It's not the most reliable test or finding. So anyway, so yeah, that pretty much concludes Cub's assessment. Anything else you want to assess at this point, Spencer?
I think this assessment actually, you know, there's some pieces missing that I'd want, but it really does give us some good clues as to what might be going on with this patient. You know, like we have the high blood sugar and altered mentation. And so my first thought is DKA, like you said, especially, you know, with the fruity breath and rapid breathing, though I'd expect to see sort of more Kussmaul's breathing. And this patient seems to be, from the description, seems to be taking more shallow breaths, but you know, she's also 700 pounds and trapped. So that, right, that could be affecting
very
that,
true.
You know, which in itself is concerning. So, but I want to make sure that I'm not just, you know, like, all right, this is DKA. I want to make sure I'm casting the wide net and not just going with the first thing that I found wrong and going with that.
Yeah.
So, you know, like there's other things that could explain what we're seeing, you know, sepsis being one of those, you know, and that also can precipitate a DKA crisis for diabetics. So that's a big thing that we want to look out for. So I'd want to look for like skin signs indicating infection, or, you know, like maybe even use last week's episode as an example and like look for signs of unilateral weakness or hemiparesis. You know, admittedly, this is hard to do with a patient who's obese and stuck between a toilet and tub.
Right.
So,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Very true. I 100% agree. Cub didn't go down the stroke assessment route, by the way, on this one. I know we addressed it last episode, but remember that even though most stroke assessments require some level of cooperation, like Spence said, you can still look for other things like hemiparesis in uncooperative patients by observing limb movement. Although it might be hard for her because, you know, her left arm is stuck, but you got feet, yeah. Feetsies. Anyway, anything you want to treat right away, Spence, based on those vitals?
I mean, there's a lot I'd like to do in terms of treatment, but, you know, I think the starting point is like, hey, let's get the patient on an end-tidal cannula and give her some supplemental oxygen, you know, at 4 liters a minute and see how she responds to that. Might have to go up. I think secondary things, you know, we don't have a radial pulse. She's tachycardic. IV with, you know, some fluid administration. Mm-hmm. Again, you know, I'd kind of want the lung sounds, but, you know, we'll start there. 12 lead I'd like done. And maybe like, I don't know, is there something, this is me just kind of like antsy for them. Like, is there anything we can do to get her out of that position? Because I, you know, it's hard to treat a patient who's essentially just stuck between a rock and a hard place, or, you know, would the rock be the tub or the toilet? And what would the hard place be?
You know what? Those are all good things, but I'm not sure which ones. Or which one would be which. So Cub has Joey place the patient on an NRB at 10 LPM and notices SaO2 seems to climb pretty rapidly towards and even eventually achieves 100%. But for the record, Spence, I would have gone your route to the end-tidal nasal cannula. I really want to know what this patient's end-tidal is. I think that's an important finding, but we don't get to know that. So,
darn it.
Yet. After Cub's assessment, Cub recognizes that the patient is sick and admits that at this point they kind of start to feel a little bit underwater. They didn't have a really good fix on what had happened, and Jeb seems irritated by their presence, but Jeb is really the only source of history. Cub is finally able to piece together the following story from Jeb's short, terse answers and sarcastic jokes.
I really will say, Jeb and people like him, it's really one of the most frustrating aspects of the job. Because you have a patient who can't give you information, and then the only person who's there is, like, this hostile family member. And they're the only person you can get history from. And that, like, that sucks.
Yeah, it is. And it is so frustrating. Like, one of the things Cub mentioned is that Jeb didn't really seem to, like, grasp the situation at all. And really just wanted things to be wrapped up and done. I'm sure Jeb is used to the fire department showing up, you know, picking up the patient off the floor and then bouncing. But yeah, basically, Jeb is unsure how long the patient has been there. He has been in his room watching TV for most of the day. And she has been complaining about feeling ill over the past few days. And, quote, has to take a piss every 5 minutes.
Oh.
Yeah. But this is nothing new, and she always feels ill, according to Jeb. Jeb says he got up and made some food around maybe noon, and that's when he went to use the restroom that the patient was in. The door, which has no lock, was open, and she was in her current position. He said he told her that he would call the fire department again, but doesn't recall if she said anything back. She takes medications, and one of them is a shot, he says, but she's always losing the equipment. I'm guessing he means needle and syringe. He points to a pill minder. Yeah. He points to the pill minder, presumably the patient's, sitting on top of a pile of mail, all of that which is sitting on top of a table, the kitchen table. There are no labels to be found. There is a prescription bottle for gabapentin on the same table and large containers of generic multivitamins, and that's all they have. Really quick, guys, gabapentin, as we talked about before, I believe in our last episode, gabapentin is a medication that is typically used to treat pain due to neuropathy. Neuropathy, by the way, is something that diabetics commonly have. So,
yeah. Yeah. Did they think to check the fridge?
No, but why?
Well, obviously to grab a cold one and just hang with Jeb, watch TV,
right?
And maybe talk about how things are going for the guy since he dropped out of the 2016 election. No, I...
Oh, political humor. EMS 2020 has it all. I didn't even think about
Jeb!
That. I didn't. Wasn't his logo just his name with an exclamation mark and the year beneath it?
Yep.
That's...
Yep.
Which it almost looks like a... Like, go Google that logo. I remember distinctly because I remember thinking like, oh, is this a new search engine? And they're like, oh, no, it's a political campaign. But it looks like an ad for a search engine to me. Like back when there was like Yahoo and Excite and like all these different things before everyone was just like, yeah, we're doing Google. But anyway, so.
No, I, the reality is you want to check the fridge because that's often where insulin is stored.
Okay.
And okay. So it's more, it's just further confirmation of like, okay, this is where like the patient is a diabetic, but it's information that we already seem to have. So,
Cub is now nervously anticipating their next move. Joey says, hey, should we try and move her? And Cub makes a choice that they now realize was ridiculous and say, yes, let's attempt to move an uncooperative 700-pound patient from between the tub and the toilet by ourselves with no real plan on where they moved the patient to. Cub just remembers feeling that they were in a position where they wanted to do something, and this was the something that they could do. Cub wanted to get, which I relate to that. Cub wanted to get an IV before the ambulance arrived and possibly administer fluids due to the severe hyperglycemia, but the exposed right arm had poor vasculature and Cub wanted to see if Lefty was any better. Cub also wanted lung sounds, as Spencer also wanted, because of the low SAO2 earlier. I was trying to see if there's another reason for that, and felt that it could be done much better from the back, which is pretty true, and especially in obese patients. So with that, they plan to tip the patient back to the seated position from her left leaning / laying one. Once upright, they would then slide the patient forward away from the wall. None of that happened. The patient didn't budge. The only thing they accomplished was discovering some additional hurdles to treatment. As they achieved the only movement of the patient that they could possibly muster, they saw what Cub described as a sight similar to when you separate one piece of bread from the other in a peanut butter sandwich. Except instead of peanut butter, it's shit. And instead of bread, it's the patient's back. This releases the previously sealed in aroma that is now barely standable, even through their N95 mask. Yes, this is COVID times, by the way.
I mean, the good news is my nose is pretty, like it blunts a lot of that out, but... Boy, I've definitely encountered that where you crack the seal and then everyone vomits. I'm not immune. I'm not immune.
Yeah. So three things now happen. Cub realizes his defeat. Cub realizes that the ambulance is here. And Cub realizes that they're totally spaced, calling for a second engine to assist with this patient. Definitely should have been done.
To be fair, I'm really guilty of doing this. I have this awful habit of assuming that basically what I have on hand is all that I have to work with. So it's like, all right, we have our kits and us and this wet piece of paper with large circles drawn with smaller circles inside
it. This arts and crafts time with Spencer again. Is that what we're doing?
But you know what? We'll find a way to make it work, or Spencer, just ask for the resources you need, call for help.
Yeah, do that.
Change. Yeah. Yep.
Do that, especially in a system where it's pretty typical the second engine will be there. So it's good to go for. Cub is radioing for the dispatch to start a second crew and is relieved that this crew is already at the station, but that's still 15 to 20 minutes out. The ambulance crew now enters. Calf and Hatchling step into the foul smelling restroom, and Cub notes that Hatchling is a paramedic and Calf is an EMT basic. Cub begins to give Hatch the rundown. Hatch looks at Cub and just says, okay, so what's next? Should we do a 12 lead? Cub's little heart sinks. Cub was also hoping that this paramedic was going to bring experience and assurance to this scene, but now Cub has the sneaking suspicion that Hatch is as new as they are. Cub confirmed this after the call, that while Hatch isn't as new as Cub, this is their first week being in an ambulance as the most experienced paramedic.
Oh, gotcha.
So okay. Yeah, and I think it was just kind of like, because I've been there as a new medic where suddenly you see someone who you hope is more experienced, and then they're like, okay, well, what do you think we should do? And you're like, I don't know. I wanted you to know that.
I actually wanted you to come in and save me because I'm drowning in this shitty scene, literally.
Yeah,
shitty scene.
Exactly. Having nothing else to do, they're like, well, yeah, let's attempt the 12 lead. So they do attempt the 12 lead, but they can't reach the areas where V5 and V6 should be placed, as that is smooshed against the tub and likely has peanut butter, we'll call it, smeared all over. So you've got this going on. What would you do with what you have here? You have your vitals, some extra help in the form of two more people, and about 20 minutes to wait before you can really get the appropriate amount of people you need. What do you do in 20 minutes besides go hang out with Jeb?
Well, I'm hanging out. We're talking politics and having a beer. This is sort of a shitty situation. I mean, maybe they have better equipment to, get a blood pressure. I'm curious what the 12 lead showed, but, you're just kind of stuck. Hopefully they can move her out with the four of them, which two could not do. So that would be my only hope, is that they're able to, to move her out. But otherwise you're just kind of stuck in the same waiting pattern. Man, that sucks.
Mm-hmm. That is awful. This is just a terrible situation. But hey, our crew decides that now they have four people and they're going to try to move the patient once more.
All right.
To at least get an IV and maybe some lung sounds. With four people, they are marginally more successful. They place the patient onto her bottom, as previously planned, and with one person on each limb, they pull the patient out. The patient does, by the way, kind of open her eyes and go, oh, as they pull her across the floor, which I imagine sounds like the same sound you get when you drag a suction cup across a refrigerator. Due to the patient's anatomy, no support is actually needed, and the patient remains in the upright seated position. Cub gets his sought after lung sounds. Cub can hear diminished lung sounds in the uppers and very little, if anything, in the lowers, which again could be due to anatomy. Plus, if she's breathing shallowly, she may just not be taking a deep enough breath to really resonate the lowers. So Hatch begins to look at the left arm, but they simply say, oh man, as they noted the patient's left arm to be severely bruised and no vasculature is visible. Can we just get her going? Asks Hatch, shortly before also asking for oceanfront property in Arizona. Cub reassures Hatch. something else that just can't happen right now. Cub reassures Hatch that help should be there shortly and suggests that they both continue to look for an IV. They make an attempt each, both attempting on the right arm, but no luck is to be had. The patient, by the way, did not move during the IV sticks. With our second engine crew less than 5 minutes out, Joey reassures Cub that he will, not even once, say anything that brings Cub any modicum of joy. Guys, look at the monitor. Does she have a pulse? Shit.
Oh.
Yeah, shit is right. What Joey notices is that the patient is now in V-fib and still sitting upright in the middle of the floor, by the way, with her chin now tucked to her chest. Not a great position.
I want to make two real quick comments.
Yeah.
Thoughts. Do we know how... We have no idea. It just occurred to me, like, we really have no idea how long this patient's been there, right?
We don't. We really don't.
Okay.
Yesterday was the last time that, you know, presumably she was seen normal. So at some time throughout the night, she may have moved in there. Because Jeb was by himself in his room watching TV and just assumed she wasn't there. So, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. Gotcha. And then the other one is... You know, like, this might be a patient, and I'm just thinking of this now, where an IO early on might have been a good placement, like a humeral IO. But anyway, go on. Sorry.
Yeah. Hey, no worries. And that is going to come into play. But Cub also kind of has a little bit of a dirty little secret here. Cub felt kind of relieved when the patient coded, because at least Cub now knows exactly what to do and kind of got like a second wind for the call.
Yes, like there is weirdly nothing harder than a patient who is like peri-arrest.
Yeah.
And then you're like, because there's a lot of anxiety. You're trying to prevent them from, you know, hitting that bottom. But, you know, like, boy, when they hit that bottom, the relief is that it's like, okay, well, I know exactly what needs to happen now.
Yeah.
Well, like, there isn't any ambiguity.
Patients are kind of like this. Like, imagine, like, you know, you put a vase up on like a pedestal or something, right? And it starts to wobble and it's going and it's about to fall. And you're kind of freaking out. What side of the vase do I run to stop? What side can I get there quick enough? Well, once it falls and shatters on the ground, well, it's not going to get any more broken. No one freaks out over that. You just walk over and take care of it. That's kind of what a code's like. Pericode, they're wobbling on the pedestal. You're freaking out. How am I going to make this thing stop? You know, am I big enough to even hold it up? But once it hits the ground, fuck it. You know what?
Oh,
get the broom. Anyway.
That is a perfect analogy. Well, no, well done. That's it exactly.
Thank you. All right. And here's the thing. So someone dying shouldn't really be funny, but it might be hard not to laugh at Cub's description of what Joey does next. I did. So Cub tells Joey, hey, start compressions, while Cub scrambles for the defib pads. Joey panics a little bit and wants to lay the patient supine, which is understandable because the patient's still seated. So Joey doesn't really coordinate this effort. So to accomplish this, Joey just grabs the nearest ankle of the patient and pulls it really hard. I'm assuming in hopes to tip the patient onto their back, but this doesn't happen. The patient's in the seated position. They just rotate like they're sitting on a turntable. But what the fuck was the plan, Joey? Like,
I'm really confused by this move.
I think he just wanted to lay her down. His idea was to just like pull the ankle and slap that head down, slap that cranium right down to the floor, I guess.
That's the best outcome, is that she just sort of like, you pull the ankle, she tips back and like smashes her head on the ground. This is a poor plan.
Yeah. So ultimately, Calf, the EMT from the ambulance, jumps in and helps supinate the patient. Cub places the patches on the patient after Joey cuts away the nightgown, revealing extensive bruising on the patient's left side.
Okay.
Cub immediately defibs the patient after clearing the patient, of course, and then presumes a PIC role with the following assignments. So Cub steps back, yay, with the monitor to be PIC. They assign Joey to compressions and Calf to BVM and Hatch to get an IO. So things seem to be going okay at first. And here's the thing. I know Spencer and I always say, like, hey, avoid, you know, when you're being PIC, you don't want to really be in charge of any interventions. When you have four people, you're going to have to do something. Okay. So this isn't one of those things where you stand back and be like, well, no one's going to run the monitor today. Like, that's not going to happen. So things seem to be going okay at first. Hatch gets the IO in quickly and right in the proximal tibia. This is one criticism that Cub has of their own agency, or at least of this particular volunteer department. The medical director only allows them to have one attempt at each tibia. They are not allowed to do humeral IOs. The tibia is the only site they are allowed, the proximal tibia.
Oh, we are stuck back in 2016.
Yeah. So yes. Oh, goodness. Anyway, the IO is placed in the tibia. And it appears to flush okay. So Cub notices that it has a sofa button appearance. The sofa button appearance is nothing official. It's something I've kind of made up. But basically, when you take the IO needle and you push it into an obese patient, if you recall what a button on a sofa often looks like, the button is often recessed into the sofa and the fabric kind of gets sucked down into it, you know, like a whirlpool almost of leather. Well, an IO in an obese patient where it has to compress a lot of fat to be able to get down to the bone kind of has the same appearance.
Quick question for you. Do you know, did they use what size needle did they use?
They did use the yellow. I was going to bring that up later because it will be pertinent. But yes, they did use the yellow, which is the longest. No, you're all good. Which is the longest needle available. So Hatch notices after Hatch places the IO, they then notice the BBM is not connected to O2 and then accomplishes that while Joey continues CPR. Hatch asks Cub if they want him to just drop a king. Cub says, sure, but let's do that in a bit. Let's get ready to push Epi. Quick but appropriate tangent here, guys. Solid PIC move. I was actually really proud to hear this. Hatch was trying to be helpful, and that's great, but Cub did very well to keep Hatch focused on where they need to be. Yes, a supraglottic airway placement can be quick, but they can at times need a little troubleshooting, and if things don't go well, you can quickly lose your only paramedic on the scene. So good move on Cub's part. I don't think we've talked about that a lot in the show, is what happens when, you know, people try to be unruly. This isn't unruly, but you get what I mean. They're self-assigning.
They kind of go out of their lane to start helping. And like it is, they're trying to be helpful, but you can bog down the steps that you need to have taken prior to getting to there.
Absolutely.
By trying to jump ahead. So, yeah.
So, Hatch readies the 1 milligram preloaded Epi 1 to 10,000 dose a few seconds before the 2-minute mark. 2 minutes is up, and Cub says stop compressions while staring at the monitor. Cub calls out V-fib, tells Joey to compress while Cub charges the monitor. The monitor is charged, Cub says clear, the shock delivered, and Hatch is ordered to push the Epi. Hey, something is wrong. The IO is no good. Cub looks over and notices that the sofa button appearance is gone, and the needle seems to just wobble in place. Cub doesn't have to ask Hatch to place another IO. Hatch confirms they are supposed to use the yellow needle, which is probably a confirmation more driven by nerves, because the yellow is clearly the longest needle in this kit, and using a shorter needle wouldn't make any sense, considering this is likely one of the largest humans they will ever encounter during their career. So, the IO is placed very quickly, and the amp of D50, and the amp of Epi gets pushed. Boy, D50 would have been the wrong fucking call. Yeah. I might leave that in because that's funny. Anyway, oh god. CPR continues for 2 minutes by Joey as Hatch places a king airway with little trouble, and the ETCO2 is attached. And here you go, Spence. The ETCO2 comes back with a good waveform, and the values are in the low 20s. So 2 minutes go by. A shock is delivered, compressions resumed, and second IO is also now bad.
Same thing.
All right. So second engine crew arrives, and here's the bad part. Per their protocols, they only get one attempt per IO site.
Yeah.
So yeah, this is not great.
Okay.
So our second in engine crew arrives, unaware that this is a code now, by the way, surprise, bringing an additional 4 EMT basics. The crew is great, and Joey is finally able to stop what had to be the most laborious chest compressions of his life and take a quick break. Without vascular access, most of the additional personnel are used for logistics in moving the patient and CPR. Hatchling takes over the monitor so that Cub can step back into the PIC role a little bit more and manage the chaos. The strategy chosen to move the patient is to roll the patient and place a mega mover under them, and using 6 people to lift the patient while a 7th person slides the gurney under the patient. CAF raises a concern that the gurney weight limit is 700 pounds, and that the patient may be over 700 pounds. But the fuck it, just do it anyway, reasoning prevails. Another 2 minutes.
Yeah, hold on, I'm going to interrupt. I don't know what their program allows.
Yeah.
But like in our ground service, a patient who's critical and who weighs over the weight, like the maximum weight of the stretcher, what we do is we just put them on the, like we recognize they're critical, we carry them out to the ambulance, and we just put them on the floor of the ambulance to transport them to the hospital.
Yeah.
Now again, that's our program, but that might have been a good consideration here too. So I don't know what they allow, but
yeah, I agree. Anyway. A lot of ambulances have the removable horns. The horns is the apparatus that the front of the gurney clicks into, and it's good to just pull those up and put them down. I guess even if you couldn't pull that up, you could do it, but I wouldn't want to. So another 2 minutes passes, another shock delivered for the resulting V-fib, and then they stop CPR to move the patient onto the soon-to-be overloaded gurney. And Spence, guess what happens?
Oh God, I don't. I mean, now I'm going like the gurney just crumbles. It's just crumbles under her.
So the gurney works just fine and doesn't crumble. There's no issue. So compressions are continued. Just wanted to fuck with you a little bit. So compressions are continued while the gurney is moved out to the ambulance. Calf hops up to drive. Cub is in the back with Hatchling, Joey, and two firefighters from the engine. Cub didn't talk to Jeb before he left, but Jeb had actually gone back into his room and was unaware that the patient had coded before they left, and was reportedly besides himself with grief and anger. The firefighter who spoke to Jeb determined it would be unsafe to have Jeb ride along in the ambulance. So I don't know how Jeb eventually got to the hospital, but good call. Family members can be a safety hazard, and you don't want them in the cabin where they could affect the driver. So,
yeah.
Cub performs a rhythm analysis once in the back of the ambulance, and at this point notes an organized rhythm that, this is the quote, I have no more detail than this, looks ugly, really slow, and doesn't have a pulse. Cub calls it PEA and compressions are continued, which is entirely appropriate. It is a 35-minute code 3 run to the nearest ER, which is their protocol for coded patients, regardless of the hospital's capabilities. That said, this is a PCI-capable hospital, so it would be appropriate either way. Hatchling and okay. Cub continue to look for and attempt to achieve SCR access, but this never happens. Cub is not certain of the number of attempts, but it's a few.
And I'm hoping that they didn't just look in the arms, that they looked at like the feet, legs, you know, like
EJs,
IJs. Yeah, EJs. Yeah. Yep.
Which is the jugulars, by the way, for anyone that doesn't know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But okay. So they did look at all those spots.
I don't know. I honestly didn't ask. Okay. They just said they looked everywhere and tried and again and got nothing.
Okay. Well, we'll assume everywhere meant everywhere.
Yeah. So, hey, the next few rhythm checks are this agonal slow PEA before getting to a systole. They arrive at the ER where the patient is coded and the RNs look for access. The physician winds up just placing another IO in one of the already used tibias where it just stays. So
when the doctor does it.
Yeah, sure. Right. Exactly. So that said, the code is called shortly after the successful placement. So it didn't really make much of a difference.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's unfortunate.
Yeah. Mm. That's a nightmare of a call.
All right. And so that's it. That's the call, huh?
That's the call.
Oh, God. Man, you're right. That was a hard call. So let's do the summary. So essentially, make sure I got this right. We have Cub and Joey. Love the names on this. Because they're both new, yeah. And they've never run a call together, and they head out to what they hoped was going to be just a simple lift assist with no medical problems. But it wasn't. They got upgraded to code 3 on the way for a breathing thing, and then they found just this massive 700-pound altered patient just fucking stuck between this bathtub and toilet, tipped onto their left side. And the patient is hyperglycemic, we're worried about DKA or just, other really incredibly bad things. And they're just not able to move her out. Her vitals are concerning. When they do finally get more help there, 20 plus minutes later, the patient's finally moved out with that ambulance crew. And then the patient just essentially arrests. Right after they do that.
Oh, God.
It is because why not?
Right.
Why the fuck not? Yeah. And so then they're able to push. It sounds like they probably pushed a single amp of epi into her leg.
Yeah.
And not actually into the vasculature, given the IO.
So no, they actually pushed so they had the first IO fail, and Hatch realized that before they pushed the first amp. Then Hatch did the second IO and immediately pushed while that IO was still in place. And then when they went to go push a second amp, that IO had then dislodged. So they did get one into
okay.
the IO.
So they got, okay, so they get one round of epi, but then essentially they have no vascular access afterwards because their protocols. Sorry, guys, that sucks.
It does.
But they're able to, shock the patient, but then she just kind of converts into this slow PEA. And granted, help has come. And they're able to load the patient and drive her to the hospital. But, unfortunately, this is sort of, it sounds like this is, too little too late at this point. This is really a nightmare call.
It really
this
is.
This sucks.
Yeah, nightmare sounds about right. I don't think I would wish this call on anyone. It is a giant clusterfuck. But let's kind of dive into the things that went right and the things that went oh so wrong. There are some clinical points and there's some more kind of tactical points to make here. But first, let's look at a few things that could explain why the patient coded in the first place. And then let's dive into if there was anything that the crew could have done past what they did to avert this outcome. So I'm going to start with the likely lead up to the patient's current condition. But just to be clear, this is all presumed. We don't really have a clear picture on what happened leading up to the patient getting stuck between the toilet and the tub, and Jeb didn't unmoney the waters at all. So, and by the way, we are about to talk about electrolytes and fluid shifts, and I know that this is a shit that puts most students to sleep in class, but trust me, you will want to stay awake for this. This is actually interesting. It's EMS 2020. We've actually made a boring thing interesting.
We do that here.
We try.
Yeah, we try.
My guess is that the patient was headed to or possibly arrived at DKA or diabetic ketoacidosis.
Huh.
Yeah.
Interesting, because I was actually thinking more like hyperosmolar or hyperglycemic syndrome or non-ketotic syndrome, whichever syndrome, whatever it's called. Is it HHNS or HHS?
Yeah, so there's two ways to say it. You have hyperosmolar hyperglycemic state and hyperosmolar hyperglycemic non-ketotic state. I have heard that some people don't like the use of non-ketotic because while a signature part of it is that it is not, the patient is not in ketoacidosis, which is different than diabetic ketoacidosis, ketones may still be present. So non-ketotic may not be the most accurate descriptor of
okay.
it. Okay. So, yeah. All so right. anyway, so, but you know what? HHS, that saves us a few syllables in saying it. So why don't we just stick to that for that sake?
As a person who stumbles over the simplest words, I appreciate it. Yeah. Okay. I was thinking HHS, but yeah, your point about like the fruity breath earlier with the like ketones sort of does fit this patient better. And we really, we honestly don't know what type of diabetic she is other than she takes shots. Thanks, right. Jeb.
I mean, I take shots every weekend, so do I have diabetes?
Different shots, man. Different shots.
Maybe that's what Jeb meant. Maybe this is all an alcohol overdose and we just completely missed the boat.
Oh, shit. That's it. Exactly. Right. Yeah, but the shots, insulin shots being a mandatory piece for type 1 and, you know, a maybe piece for type 2. So anyway.
All right. So those are kind of the two possibilities, right? You have hyperosmolar hyperglycemic state or HHS, and you have DKA or diabetic ketoacidosis. Both of these conditions have a lot in common, especially in how they present and in what you're going to do for them in the field. But let's start with HHS since you brought it up. And to your point, HHS is more likely to occur in adults than DKA is. So that I'll totally concede. So to understand what's going on in HHS, you need to know a few things. The fluid inside your body has a property that we call osmolarity. Osmolarity is determined by the ratio of solutes to water. Like, for example, salt in water is saline. Okay. So the osmolarity of fluid is the amount of salt in that water. This is important because fluid exists throughout your body in various spaces and moves based on osmolarity. When the osmolarity of a fluid in a specific area changes, that will cause fluid to move. Sometimes that's a good thing. Sometimes it is a totally bad thing. Today, totally bad thing. When you have too much of a solute in fluid, like for example, having too much glucose in the blood, like the glucometer reads high, which really I want a glucometer just says, what the fuck? Like, what do I do? How much sugar is this? Or it just says like Mrs. Butterworth's because it thinks you just put syrup in it. So what ends up occurring at capillary sites is that the water will shift out of cells in our various tissues into the capillaries through the capillary walls. We've talked about this before on the show, but fluids on either side of a semi-permeable, meaning that some things like water can pass through a barrier, like to have the same osmolarity. Because the solutes are typically too large to cross through this barrier without a process called active transport, we're not going to get into that. The only solution to make the osmolarity equal on either side of the barrier is to have the water move to the area of higher solute concentration from the area of low solute concentration. So in HHS, you have a concentration of solutes in the blood that is much higher than the concentration of solutes in the cells of your tissues, owing to the excessive amount amount of glucose. And by excess, I'm talking over 600 or 33 millimoles. And a lot of our EMS monitors only read up to 500. So anyway, So water is chasing the glucose. This means that water is leaving cells, going into vasculature, which causes massive intracellular dehydration. But it gets worse. The kidneys try their damnedest to get rid of all the extra glucose through urination, a lot of urination, which only serves to further dehydrate the patient and worsen this cycle. If left untreated, this can actually lead to circulatory collapse and a host of other problems. And remember, our patient was, to quote Jeb, taking a piss every 5 minutes.
Yeah.
Now, I do want to note that excessive urination and excessive thirst also, by the way, are signs of both onsetting DKA and HHS. It does share both of these things. So there can also be a shifting of electrolytes out of the cells into vasculature along with the water, which can elevate things like serum potassium. By the way, that means potassium in the blood. And there is a distinction that needs to be known between potassium that's in your blood and potassium that's in your cells. But another thing to keep in mind, or what you need to keep in mind, is the kidneys, assuming they're working, which if the patient's peeing every 5 minutes, they probably were, is going to excrete those too, leading to a net depletion of electrolytes. And that kind of makes this big mess, and this is going to build up over time. So what you end up having is, while you have a net depletion of electrolytes, potassium, sodium, because it's been moved out of the cells, the potassium you do have is all sitting in your bloodstream right now. So you end up having an elevated level of potassium in your blood that more than you would normally expect in a healthy human. But you have almost none of it in the cells where it needs to be, or at least the cells it needs to be in. So let's move on to diabetic ketoacidosis, or DKA. This is also caused by hyperglycemia and also carries with it all of the problems of osmolarity changes and fluid shifts, but has the added excitement of... There's a drum roll in case it doesn't come through in editing.
Puppies. Acidosis.
Puppies. Acidosis. Wouldn't that be great? That's the only difference. Is this HHS or is this DKA? Hey, did the patient have a puppy with him? No, but I saw a kennel in the car. Let's go see if there's a puppy there. Yep, there's a puppy there. It's DKA. All right. No, actually, the phytosine can be totally negative in this case, and you can still have it. No, the added excitement is acidosis. What happens in DKA patients is that there isn't insulin available for glucose to be used for cellular energy. And that's going to cause the liver to go ahead and use fatty acids as fuel instead. And these fatty acids are metabolized by the liver into ketones and ketoacids. And the body can actually handle this for a time, but eventually it won't be able to rid itself of the excess ketoacids, and blood pH will drop, causing acidosis. It is not well understood why the liver makes this change in some patients and not others. This process also causes the patient to pee a whole lot, which leads to dehydration. It also tends to make them nauseated and makes them vomit, which also does not help with dehydration. Plus, the profound acidosis that goes along with this condition shifts potassium out of the cells and into the intravascular fluid, which then raises their serum potassium, that's potassium floating around in your bloodstream, to potentially, well, let's just call it a cardiac dysrhythmia level, like on a scale of zero to cardiac dysrhythmia. It's cardiac dysrhythmia.
It's so, an 11.
Yeah, it's an 11.
Man, I really like these summaries, dude. But man, it's not clear which one in this case it would be for this patient, because like both of them, it could potentially be either of them. Like, yeah, my understanding is that like the HHS usually has sort of a slower onset compared to like DKA. So maybe the days of being ill per Jeb kind of lead more to HHS.
Quick correction there. So DKA is more rapid than HHS typically, but keep in mind when they say more rapid, they're still talking over several days. So DKA, so it's still a condition that occurs over a couple days. It's just HHS is more days than DKA. So
gotcha.
Typically.
And being ill could also be a trigger for DKA.
It can
like,
be. It really
could
can be.
For HHS. Yeah. So, all right. Yeah. So really, boy, either of these could be at play. I wish Jeb was a better historian for the cruise.
But hey, that's not all. Let's talk about that left arm and actually the whole left side of her bruised up body. So I'm going to suspect that this patient has been down and in that position for some time, potentially hours, which, by the way, is a testament to their blood sugar. No food for hours. Still high. Solid work. The patient's weight. The patient's weight, I think it's fair to call extreme. And all of that pressure, the patient's own weight, is on the patient's left side and arm. The left arm was revealed to be bruised extensively, as well as the left side of the body. And while this isn't what we typically think of when we think of like patients in a crush injury, the mechanism and the time is absolutely present. So what happens exactly in a crush injury? So when muscle tissue is compressed, which her arm definitely was, for long periods of time, blood flow gets diverted away from it and muscle cells break down. When they break down, our friends myoglobin and potassium will occur in that crushed area along with lactic acid.
Oh, with friends like these. Am I right?
Yep. You're, you're right, buddy.
Oh, fuck off.
I'm going to leave that in too. So, sorry, man. I feel almost like a dick, but I'm like a threat. The threat is just to leave the shit you say in the show. I'm sorry, man. That was meaner than I wanted to be. It wasn't.
You okay? You need a hug tonight?
Yeah. Are you good? All right. So we have another disease process to consider here. One that also needs fluid, because we want to try and help the kidneys handle the myoglobin, and one that also increases the risk of generating excess potassium. And this is why understanding physiology is so damn important, and why you should not fall asleep in this part of class, because these are the calls that will fuck you if you do. And understanding metabolic disease is important. You can't really test for hyper-K in the field. The labs inside the ambulance are just too slow. But we can certainly use history as a very strong indicator, and this patient has buckets of that.
And if we're thinking about hyper-K as a likelihood, and I agree that in this situation we should, because all of these conditions can increase the patient's, you know, the amount of potassium in their blood, we really should be watching out for some important EKG changes as well. And like, this is a really good reason to do 12 leads on these types of patients. And now I wish I could have seen this EKG, because I'd be really curious what it showed when they took it. You know, again, typically what we see with hyper-K is we start seeing a loss of P waves, a slowing of the rate, a widening of that QRS. We'll start noticing these large and kind of sharp pointed T waves. And eventually we'll get to like a Z-fold pattern with that QRS extending out. And then, you know, in more severe cases, as the potassium increases, eventually it'll just kind of become this oscillating sine wave of bad. So
my guess is that what is very likely to be a substantially dehydrated patient that needs fluid resuscitation, along with the excessive amount of potassium likely present in the patient's blood, made them ripe for a lethal dysarrhythmia. And this is the problem with having so much potassium in the blood, even if you probably have a net loss of potassium. Hyperkalemia will then affect the heart itself. So that can cause the QT interval changes, like shortening early on or prolongation as it becomes more severe. And that can lead to R-on-T. R-on-T is basically where the heart is repolarizing or resetting, and then a depolarization impulse occurs right in the middle of that. And that causes typically ventricular fibrillation is what that will go into.
Yeah.
So that leads to the ultimate question, though. Could the crew have prevented this? Spencer, what do you think?
I mean, this situation sucks. Mm-hmm. That's what I think. I think not being able to reliably get vascular access on a patient who actually really, really, really needed fluids at minimum,
right?
Or, and I think you really made the case here, based on just sort of how this call unfolded and how the patient coded, probably needed something to temporize the potential hyperkalemia that they likely were in. And that's just, man, it's a big deal, and it'd just be an awful spot to be in, just to not be able to get that access. HHS totally needs a ton of fluids, as does DKA and Crush.
Yeah.
So right. So without access, man, I'm not sure what they could have done here.
Yeah. And to be honest, there's really not. If they were able to obtain vascular access, they would have more options. But there is one treatment they could have done. I'll kind of pin that later. I mean, I don't think it's a treatment that was really going to tip this one way or the other. But yeah. As for getting IV access, I do have one thought on that. I have a couple thoughts, actually. So what I would have done after you see, you know, we talk about the sofa button effect, right? And what that is you basically, the reason it keeps dislodging is you have a ton of fatty tissue being compressed as you push that into the bone. And that fatty tissue wants to uncompress. And in doing so, it will push the needle out. Once you get those in a bariatric patient, you will now dedicate someone to holding that in. And that's where they're going to stay. They're just going to stay and they're going to hold that in so it doesn't push out. That's kind of the best thing. Oh. So here's the other thing I would do. I would have called OLMC. Unfortunately, this municipality seems to have some, I'm just going to bluntly say it. These are really restrictive protocols in terms of IO placement. I mean, that's kind of old school to where you only have just the two, tibial sites and that's it. That was like when IO started, like when you and I were starting, like doing our paramedic course, that's what was taught. And I want to say shortly after that, people were like, well, hey, maybe we should do some other sites, you know, and now we have a litany of sites that we get to choose from. But yeah, they get one shot each. I mean, in this case, here's the thing. The patient's dead. Like, you're not going to make them. You will not code her harder by trying the same site a third or by trying another site a second time. And ultimately, that's what the physician did. So what I would have done if I was really concerned about my protocols, I'd have called OLMC and said, hey, we've used up our two attempts. We have nothing for vascular access. This patient needs fluid. Here's why. I don't really see a doc being too apprehensive about being like, yeah, just like try it again. Like, you're not going to make her worse. It's not like an infant where there's an epiphyseal plate you have to worry about damaging and bone growth down the line. She's grown. Okay. She's full grown in all aspects. So, you know, you're fine. And so that's what I think I would have done.
No, that's a really good thought with the OLMC. And like, I never would have thought about having just like, hey, man, you're holding that IO in, especially after the first one popped out. And then you get to see that happen again for the second one. Like, somebody hold that. The thought I had is that this is one of those situations where, like, I found in patients where access is really sparse, bad, the inside of the wrist near the hand usually has some visible surface veins, even on obese patients, that you usually can see them. And again, I've encountered them with really bad vasculature. You can sneak, usually get a 24 or a 22 if you're really feeling lucky, in that with a pretty decent rate of success. But, you know, the downside is they're small, so you're not getting nowhere near the fluid you need or the patient needs. But, it's access.
There's also, and here's the thing, this is not Instructor Chris. This is Chris has been in a similar situation, Chris. There's also the blind sticking. This is not great in this patient. But if you look, go ahead and look at your own hands. A good example is if you look between your pinky and your ring finger, you're going to see a vein right there. I have two prominent veins. Most people anatomically will have a vein there. So doing a blind stick with a smaller gauge may yield some results, but it also may not. So just to throw out the whole blind stick shot, there's that. So,
So you mentioned one treatment option here that they could have tried for hyper-K, and I think I know what you're talking about, and I'm actually a little upset that it took me this long to remember it, but I think I got it.
But hey, you know what you did get? You got the CBG, Spencer. So
with all the prompting, I nailed it.
Improvement. So hey, let's talk about hyper-K. I mean, okay. So to treat hyperkalemia, there are a few common treatments. Let's kind of start at the top of the list here. calcium, so either gluconate or chloride, depending on your municipality. IV calcium is often the drug of choice when it comes to IV drugs administered in the field with suspected hyperkalemia. Now, calcium doesn't do anything for the actual potassium levels in the blood, but it does counteract the cardiac effects that potassium has. It's the yin to the yang, if you will. This is a rapidly onsetting intervention, and it's a really good stopgap while blood potassium levels get reduced. One way to actually reduce blood potassium levels is by administering albuterol. And this is the one treatment that they could have done either prior to the movement of the patient, through the mask, or perhaps even after the patient coded via the supraglottic airway or the BVM. Now, albuterol is a bronchodilator. And so I know a lot of people are like, so what the fuck? But that's not why we like it in this particular patient. Albuterol assists in the active transport of potassium back into the cells of the tissues. Because remember, it's not there right now. Reducing the amount of potassium that's in the blood affecting the heart.
Yeah, and this is what I was thinking you were thinking of, or what you were leaning to.
Yes.
And I like to think of, like, this as kind of like, it's a shell game. You're not really reducing the overall potassium in the patient's body. You're just like, it's some sleight of hand shit that, like, moves it and makes it appear elsewhere.
Right.
But
it puts it somewhere where it can do no harm. Like, that's basically what it is.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, finally, though, I do want to talk about sodium bicarbonate. So, this used to be like the popular option. Like, I don't know about you, Spence, but I remember in class being like, yeah, if you have a crush patient, which we kind of do here, load them up on sodium bicarb before you get them out of wherever they're at. And it seems kind of like a logical choice because, but studies have shown that it actually has little impact on being able to reduce the level of potassium. And there is little evidence that it improves patient outcomes. So, the idea is that potassium requires active transport across cell membranes, and sodium aids in this by being one of the necessary components of the type of active transport the body naturally uses to move potassium. But it just doesn't really seem to play out. Another effect of sodium bicarbonate, though, is that it also may affect blood pH. Because remember, one of the things we're worried about in this patient, especially when we're talking about diabetic ketoacidosis. And when we're talking about crush injuries, where we have a buildup of lactic acid, is that the patient can then become acidotic. And sodium bicarbonate, well, get this, it's actually really good at alkalizing the blood and raising that pH back up. But this has become really controversial these days, especially in treatment of crush injuries. So one of the things here is that there's just not a lot of conclusive studies really showing that it helps. Really in a lot of acidotic situations, whether it's from lactic acidosis, which is our primary concern with a crush injury, or other types of acidosis, like DKA, for example, particularly when given as a bolus. Now, there are studies that show that sodium bicarbonate infusions over time do benefit patient outcomes. But boluses of sodium bicarbonate, like the kind we're going to be giving in the field, have very little data showing that they help. And in fact, there is a brilliant review of multiple different studies that actually shows the opposite may be true, particularly in the treatment of lactic acidosis. That study, by the way, is titled Effect of Sodium Bicarbonate Administration on Mortality in Patients with Lactic Acidosis, a Retrospective Analysis. That particular study was able to show that the mortality rate actually increased in patients who received bolus doses of sodium bicarbonate. The running theory is this. So there's an enzyme called phosphofructokinase. And you know that one, Spence, right?
Yeah, no, of course, phosphofructokinase.
Phosphofructokinase actually helps the body stop producing lactic acid. And when your blood is acidotic, the enzyme activity of phosphofructokinase is increased for that reason, to reduce the production of lactic acid. Sodium bicarbonate, unfortunately, interferes with phosphofructokinase. So it's not able to do that. So what ends up happening is we get these big boluses of sodium bicarbonate and we're like, all right, yeah, we adjusted that blood pH. Well, this study actually showed that when we do that, the patients actually end up later on with higher levels of lactic acid than they started with, actually. And the assumption, or at least the running idea, is that this could be why that's occurring is that sodium bicarbonate is actually interfering with the body's own mechanisms to reduce lactic acid. So when your sodium bicarbonate finally wears off, the lactic acid is then in abundance and basically the patients end up worse off. So that's why sodium bicarbonate is really falling out of favor and it's no longer a first-line drug in most municipalities for crush injuries.
Oh, nice. I'd heard that, but I never understood that. And that actually,
it's kind of like you heard that peeing on an electric fence is bad for you, but you kind of like, well, like, would it really like come back up? Cause it's not a solid stream. It never really truly is. But yeah, it turns out, it'll shock you. So last minute kind of, some tactical things, here that I think are important. I know this is a long episode, guys. Thank you for sticking with it. One big thing that I think really could have improved this call a long way, Spence, you kind of caught this early on. You're like, ah, shit, I'm guilty of this. And that is going to be call for your resources that you need, really quick. Especially when it comes to bariatric, you just need more people. And that is something that I wish would have been on the way, because this code might have been run a little bit better, or it frees up a paramedic to think a little bit more when you have more people doing things. You're not having to run a monitor. It also frees up the other paramedic who is now task saturated as well, potentially. And to have those people on scene initially, might have helped this out. So I would say that's kind of the one big tactical lesson. When you walk in, you see a 700-pound patient, realize immediately that you and your buddy are not going to move them. And even if you get four people, your best case scenario with four people, I would say, is you may find a way to move them unsafely. So get more people on board early on to help eliminate that downtime of just staring at this patient with no help. So there you go. Yeah. That is all I really have for today's call. Thank you everyone again for listening. As always, you guys are fantastic. The show is doing great and we really appreciate everything you guys say. As always, get on social media, please follow us. We are EMS20/20 on Facebook. Go ahead and follow us on Instagram as well at EMS2020 show. And if you want to send us an email, please do. That's where all these calls come from. They're from you guys sent to this email address. That is EMS2020podcast@gmail.com. If you wish to advertise with us, same email address. Go ahead and send us a note. With that, Spencer, take us out awkwardly as fuck. Actually, how about this? Spencer, I vote for you to take us out awkwardly as fuck.
That's perfect, because you teed me up for something that I love, which is this. This episode reminds me of a simpler time way back in the early 2015s. I'm Jeb Bush, and I approve this message. Oh, he's honest, dependable. Loyal, relatively funny. He does not brag like some people we know. He's got the same values that America seems to have lost. We need him. And I'm not just saying that because I'm his mother.
Oh, God.
Vote Jeb.
If you're his mother, you need to stop smoking. Thank you, everybody. We will see you next Wednesday.